Today, what worship in the temple should look like.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Now, I know we don't actually have a temple right here to go to and offer sacrifices and so on, but there's a very real sense, an actual sense, in which we are the temple of the Holy Spirit. And so this really just has to do with what worship should look like ultimately. But we have a little journey to get there, and it's a journey we're going to take through the 30th Psalm. I've been working through the Psalms anyway. Recently, we did Psalm 29. You can obviously find all the other episodes that we've done, but the 41st episode of this podcast was a review of Psalm 29, where we went through it idea by idea and saw how the voice of God relates to us in this world and what we should think of it. Psalm 30 is the psalm for today, and as I'm reading through it and have studied through it, it leads to this insight into what our worship should look like, because the opening line in the psalm, the superscript of the psalm, is a psalm of David, a song at the dedication of the temple, which, by the way, should make us raise our eyebrows, since the temple wasn't built by David. It was built by Solomon, so there's no temple for him to offer a dedication for. So why is there a dedication at the temple in one of his psalms when it doesn't exist yet? And one option is just to say, well, he's anticipating when the temple is going to be built. Fine, that is certainly a possibility, and in fact, I think that's part of the picture of what's going on. Another would be to say, well, it's just sort of a misunderstanding of the word, because it's not the word that we'd normally use for temple. It's the word for house that's used, a bait. So it's the dedication of it's a dedication of his house or of a house, but not necessarily the temple. But clearly, it's language, and you can tell in it, and it's a psalm for the purpose that's used for this purpose historically in Israel, for the dedication of the temple. So there's some reason that it's applied to the temple, and I think that reason also applies to us, as we'll see as we read through the psalm. So first, there is this preface to the psalm, or this heading to the psalm, Psalm of David, a song at the dedication of the temple, followed by three verses that sort of give an overview to what we can expect in the psalm and what it's about. And so in these three verses, we just get a basic idea of what's happening. Verse 1, I will extol you, O Lord, for you have drawn me up and have not let my foes rejoice over me. O Lord, my God, this is Yahweh he's saying each time, I will extol you, O Yahweh, for you have drawn me up and have not let my foes rejoice over me. O Yahweh, my Lord, my God, I cried to you for help and you have healed me. O Yahweh, you have brought up my soul from the grave, from Sheol. You restored me to life from among those who go down to the pit. And we'll pick up more from there. In fact, the next two verses sort of flow with it. I'll read those to you now too. Sing praises to Yahweh, O you his saints. And you could hear this more at the dedication of a temple, right? So now he's turning to the congregation. You sing praises to Yahweh, his saints, and give thanks to his holy name, for his anger is but for a moment, and his favor is for a lifetime. Weeping may tarry for the night, but joy comes with the morning. Now, that communication in the middle of a psalm that's written as the dedication to the temple invites a little curiosity to say, what's going on, that this is what they want to utter at the dedication of the temple. What was happening that at the dedication of the temple they would need to say the words, weeping may tarry for the night, but joy comes with the morning? What is the sorrow that they were going through? And it could be any number. There's there is not a specific point here. There are a couple that I think are there, but they're iffy to a specific story in David's life that tells us what the undergirding to this was. But there are enough little pointers, little hints of what's going on that I think relating it to this story that I'm going to tie it to is the appropriate story. But regardless of whether it was this story or one that happens just when Saul is pursuing him, or one that happens when he's run out of Jerusalem and finally makes his way back, or one that happens when he originally brings, like we did in Psalm 29, when he originally brings the ark back into the temple. In any of those, this point would come across. But I want to use the story that actually leads to him standing on the plat of ground where the temple itself will be and declaring, this is where the temple will be. I want to use that story as sort of the background for understanding at least the emotions, the sentiment that goes with this psalm. So in those first five verses that we were just reading, where he is extolling the Lord, you'll notice that he doesn't say any of these terms without reference to the catastrophe that would have been coming upon him. So I extol you, O Lord, in the first verse, because you've drawn me up. So he was falling down before, or he was down before, and now he's been drawn up. And you've not let my foes rejoice over me, at enemies who were facing him. O Lord, my God, I cried to you for help. So he was needing help. And you have healed me. Whatever it was that was destroying him has been stopped, and now he's healed. In the third verse, you brought up my soul from Sheol. So there's the fear that reigns over us in this life, according to the author of Hebrews. And David is bringing it up already to say, you restored me to life among those who go down into the pit, going down into the pit. And in that context, he gives us the next two verses. But the first verse, which says, sing praises to Yahweh, O you his saints, give thanks to his holy name, and seems so pristine in its invitation to praise, is itself couched in the cause for that statement, sing praises, because, in verse 5, his anger is but for a moment. His favor is for a lifetime. Weeping may tarry for the night, but joy comes with the morning. This contrast with the enemies and fears that surround us are always present in the way we understand the goodness of God. And this is not a theological necessity. I mean, it probably is one, but I'm not arguing for that. I'm not saying it's a theological necessity. I'm just saying, what other option is there? The only way we could know God is in contrast to the enemies and fears from which he delivers us, because we were all facing enemies and fears from which he delivered us. There's no way that wouldn't be there. And for us simply to recognize that invites us into the story I want to talk about in David's life that I think undergirds, if not necessarily informs the meaning of this psalm, but at least undergirds the psalm in some ways for us to remember this story and it happening. And it's a story that finds a central piece in David's response to an offer from God. And you'll remember how all this happens. It's just after the census where he tries to count the people of Israel. Now, I'll go back and read those parts, the details of the story, in just a minute. But after he's, you know, taken the census, he's confronted by a prophet. The word of the Lord comes to the prophet Gad, David's seer, and says, go and say to David, this is in 2 Samuel 24, 11 and following. He says, go and say to David, thus says Yahweh, three things I offer you, choose one of them, that I may do it to you. So the Lord comes to Gad, says to Gad, go to David and tell him, you have a choice of what's going to happen to you in judgment for what you've done against me by taking the census. We'll talk about why that's a sin in a minute. But in verse 13, so Gad does it, comes to David and tells him and says, well, these are your three options. Shall 3 years of famine come to you in your land? Or will you flee 3 months before your foes while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days pestilence in your land? And if we don't get back to it later, by the way, keep in mind that it was 3 days of pestilence to David, the messianic figure, after which there would be an end to the judgment of God. And this great victory that brings joy and dancing from David before Yahweh, and a prayer that says, O Lord, you have brought up my soul from the grave, from Sheol. So it's worth mentioning, by the way. that in this last option, which is, or shall there be 3 days pestilence in your land? Now, again, it's a famine for 3 years or 3 months before your enemies or 3 days of pestilence in your land. Now, consider and decide what answer I shall return to him who sent me. And keep in mind that as he's hearing this, David's interpretation is going to include the assumption that a famine might just happen. Even though God sometimes uses famines to punish the land, and so we know he's not excluded from his causality in that, even in David's mind, or in anybody in the Old Testament's mind, it would be there. God would still be behind anything. And yet, the famine might just happen, the foes might just chase me, but a pestilence would be a direct act of God against the people. Because David's response, and it implies that, because David's response is in verse 14, to say to Gad, I'm in a great distress. So how do I resolve it? Let us fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercy is great, but let me not fall into the hand of man. So bring one of these consequences that's directly from God and doesn't involve the foes of the Lord, and because it becomes this days long, this pestilence that falls on the people of Israel, the angel holding his sword over the people of Israel, David has given his response. Now, you know, what's compelling about this is that David is responding, and again, I'm going to come to why it's a sin, why he's facing it, and all of that kind of stuff, and what comes out of it, the other side of it, in just a moment. That's the point of going through this psalm. But the opening of this, it's just so odd for David to say, I'd rather us be put into this terrible situation where many of us are facing death, that it would happen under the hand of the Lord, unless we keep in mind that he knows God not in some vacuum of relationship between nothing and himself or God and himself. That's not an option. The options for him are the terrible things that he faced outside of when he knew Yahweh and the mercy that he knows that Yahweh has. And he says, if that's the case, then even if it involves judgment, even if it involves death, I would rather face it at the hands of Yahweh than anything else that's going on in the world. And only a person who is considering what God is, who God is and what God is, in contrast to the enemies and fears that he had before he knew God, would make a statement like that, would express something like that. I guess, and my point, you know, my point's fairly simple here. Now, you know, to give a trivial example, and I mean a consummately trivial example of this, I remember having power windows in some of my cars back, you know, in the ancient days. And sometimes they worked and sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they worked for a while and then they quit. Other times they would work for a while and then the window would just drop in the door. And it's like, well, you know, what on earth is going on? And then if the window was stuck down when it stopped working, you were just out of luck. There was nothing you could do. Take the whole door apart, raise the window up, jam something into it and keep it up and all that kind of stuff. When I went through that, when I had, yes, obviously cheap cars that I kept until they finally stopped running, that kind of thing. When I had that situation with power windows, I would say to myself, oh, man, for the old days when we had crank windows, you know, just take the handle and crank it up and the window would go up and crank it down, the window would go down. And you didn't have to worry about whether a machine was working or not or whatever. And then I got an Audi. Nothing wrong with Audi. They make great cars. I'm just talking about way back then. It was old, and it was an old one when I got it. And it was really just a Volkswagen Fox with an Audi logo on it, you know. And nothing wrong with Volkswagens or Volkswagen Foxes. Good. More power to you if you love them and drive them. I'm happy for you. But my experience was a little bit challenging. And so what I had was an old car, and it had hand cranks on the windows. And I thought, I'm going to love this. And every time I got in the car and wanted to roll down the window on the opposite side of the car because it was 108 degrees and the air conditioner wasn't working right, and I couldn't pause in traffic to lean over and go far enough to crank the window, or I could get it one half crank, and then but you get the picture, right? When that happened, I was like, oh, you know, power windows weren't really all that bad. I kind of wish I had them. We do this all the time, and it's just human nature for us to do this. But I'm saying this about our relationship with God. We can only value our new life the way it's become in our relationship with God. We can only value our new life as much as we remember the past from which it came, from which it was delivered. If we don't, we won't grasp
the significance of what makes it different. It's not possible for us to really appreciate where we are. And in that context, there is a lot of gravity behind what I'm saying here. In that context, David saying facing a pestilence at the direct hand of God bringing judgment on his people, it actually makes sense for him to say, I know something terrible is about to happen, but I want it to happen at the hand of Yahweh. Because in comparison to every other option, whatever he brings is going to be better. I trust him more. That attitude, that demeanor is so different from what we normally think, that it's so distinct from the presumption that we have, that our lives should be blessed and good. I say this from a different psalm a lot, from Psalm 103, and I won't jump to it and start teaching from that psalm right now, but in the middle of that psalm is the same idea, the same contrast, that our presumption is that things should always be good. That's how we are as human beings. But what we really ought to presume is that whatever bad we face is not as bad as what we should face. And the only reason it's not is because of how good God is. And that actually leads into the second part of this psalm, starting in verse 6. So as we go into verse 6 now, it becomes more specific. And I think in some ways it relates more specifically to the story that we're going to talk about in David's life, with him counting in the census and then facing the judgment of God and so on. So starting in verse 6, so again, we've just gotten through the, I will extol you because you've delivered me, you brought up my soul from Sheol and so on, and weeping may tarry for a night. And by the way, so it's three nights in this episode of the pestilence, and it may be longer, but it's at least that, 3 days. And when that's over, for him to offer a prayer that would say, weeping may endure for the night, but joy comes with the morning, carries more gravity. Anyway, when we get through that section, he starts in verse 6 and says, as for me. And so now you can tell what he's really doing with that statement is going back to the beginning and saying, so let me recount to you why I would say this. Why I would say that even when terrible things have happened, when I was having to call out for help, when my foes had the possibility of causing me to lose in the battle, when only Yahweh could deliver me from the Sheol that I was facing and so on. As for me, back in those days, when all of that terrible stuff was happening, let me explain to you why I would say I'm going to trust in Yahweh. As for me, when I go back to the beginning, I said in my prosperity, so here I am being blessed, everything's going well. And I said, I shall never be moved. We sing a song like that. I shall not be moved. Those who are old, like I am, know the hymn that I'm talking about. That's as close as I get to actually singing the hymn. But this is a different sense of that. That statement in the hymn is a sense of resolve. You know, I'm committed to the Lord. I'm going to stay committed to the Lord. This statement is the resolve of someone who didn't know the Lord. He didn't have any idea what God was doing in his life, even when he was outside of his walk with God. And he says, so as for me, when I was prospering, I said in that prosperity, I'll never be moved. I have everything I possibly need here. And this is important to why David does the census and why he's judged for doing the census, as we'll talk about in just a moment. And so in verse 7, the next verse of the psalm, Psalm 30, he says, by your favor, O Lord, you made my mountain stand strong. This is him saying, oh, now I look back on it, I think, what was I thinking? I was thinking, look at the mountain I've built my house on. I'll never be moved. I'm so wealthy. I've built my house on this mountain. It'll stand firm. No one can come and get me. No flood can reach me and so on. But then he says, but you know, now I realize it, by your favor, Yahweh, you made my mountain stand strong. You hid your face then. So this is him saying, but then when something changed, when you hid your face, see, in my prosperity, I thought, oh, I'll never be moved. I know now, in reality, it was by your favor that my mountain was not being moved. So my mountain stood strong. But when you hid your face, all of a sudden I realized I was dismayed. I realized I did not have that security. So what happens in David's life in the story that I was telling you about,
where he takes the census. So we won't tell that part again. You know, he's older. He's on the throne. He's wanting to get a census of his people and count them. And it doesn't say why, but it's not hard for us to figure it out in the story. After he does that, he's going to be condemned. And so this is what happens as he has taken the census, and he's had restrictions on the census because the people that are working for him that are going to take the count, they're unhappy doing it. They know it's wrong for them to do it. They don't want to. And so they do it half-heartedly, and they don't have a good count and all that kind of stuff. And in verse 10 of 2 Samuel 24, before Gad comes to him with the judgment that I read to you a moment ago, just before that in verse 10, it says, but David's heart struck him. Now, this is the man after God's own heart, right? So there's something in David's heart that tells him, oh, no, this is wrong. I shouldn't have done this. David's heart struck him after he had numbered the people. And David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly. Those statements, that it was David's heart that struck him, that he sinned greatly, that he has done, that he says, I have done very foolishly, they tell you exactly what's going on with this sin of counting the people, of having a census. And what it goes back to is Saul. So, you know, we go back to Saul's story, and not long after he becomes king, Samuel tells him to go to Gilgal and wait there for Samuel to come and to offer sacrifices and, you know, and so on. And Saul goes, and he starts to get nervous after he's been there for a week, and Samuel hasn't shown up yet. And so Saul decides that he's going to offer the sacrifice without Samuel. He says, well, I'm not going to be able to keep the people together, and I have to have enough people or I'm not going to be able to win the war. So I'll offer a sacrifice on my own time. And as soon as he finishes, of course, Samuel shows up, as you would expect. Saul didn't expect, but as anybody reading the story would expect. And then, you know, Samuel confronts him, and Saul says this. Now, this is how it goes. When I saw that the people were scattering from me, when I realized I wasn't going to have enough of an army, if you say, well, how do you know that's what he means? That's what he says. I saw that the people were scattering from me when I saw that, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash. So here they are coming to the battle with their armies, and I'm not sure I'm going to have enough people with me to fight them. I said, well, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I've not sought the favor of Yahweh yet. So I forced myself, and I offered the burnt offering on my own. And Samuel said to Saul, and by the way, in the story, it's clear Saul is doing this because he can see that the people are scattering from him. And Saul himself says that's what motivates him to do it. I saw the people were scattering from me. And so when he decides to offer the sacrifice, he can tell Samuel, oh, it's because, you know, I wanted to seek Yahweh's favor. But he tells us that that's a fiction, that the reality of why he did it was because he saw the people were scattering from him. And so Samuel said to Saul in response, you've done foolishly. David says, I have done foolishly on his own. Gad is going to rebuke him now with a judgment, with a pronouncement of the judgment that's going to come on him. But Saul, in response to Samuel has to say it to him. You have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. Because then the Lord himself would have established your kingdom. You, in the psalm, have made my mountain stand strong. The Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. You thought you were doing it, Saul, that you offering sacrifices, that you keeping the people together, that you forming up the army. That you think you're creating all of these things. You think in your prosperity you're never going to be moved. But it's Yahweh who is keeping you together. He would have established your kingdom forever over Israel. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. After his own heart. And Saul did what? So one verse later, at the end of verse 15, this is all happening in 1 Samuel 13. You can go and read it. It says, and Saul, after all of this happens, what does he do? Because his original concern was, I'm not going to have enough people to fight this war. So in verse 15, what does he do? Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. You've done foolishly, Saul. Now here's David,
the king, who takes Saul's place because he's supposed to be a man after God's own heart, which is what the Lord is seeking, because Saul thinks he has to do it on his own and build the army himself and maintain all the people himself and so on. So when David counts the people and his own people are saying to him, don't do this. You don't need to do this. The people of Israel belong to you. God is blessing you. You don't need to do this. David then realizes that he's made a mistake. Ah, his heart struck him. I have sinned greatly. I've done foolishly, because he is depending on himself instead of on the Lord. And it's not just he's taking things into his own hand. It's that he's not realizing what this psalm returns him to realizing. You know, he says this so the people can hear on a repeated basis the lesson that he had to learn through this experience and through other experiences that are similar. We don't realize that God is the one who's always been delivering us. He was the one who was keeping the mountain firm from the beginning. He's the one who put David on the throne. He's the one who can keep David on the throne. And we don't realize that God has always been delivering us until he doesn't, which is what happens with David in this story. God says, you know, I've been blessing you. You suddenly think you need to take it into your own hands. So, you know, here comes a famine, your enemies, a pestilence. Which do you want? Because that's the thing. Let's see how you do trying to face these things on your own as a people or as their king who represents all of the people. You know, what happens to the people happens to David and vice versa. That's the nature of their relationship. And so, you know, in this account, for us, it's the same thing. We don't realize that even before we knew God, he was the one who was delivering us. He's the reason that we made it to this point in life to begin with. And it's not because we were turning to him or because we were living well, but because he gives life and breath to everyone. He is the one who makes anyone's mountain stand, who gives prosperity to anyone at any time. It's really hard for us to admit that when we feel like we're the ones who have built the house. Well, perhaps you built your house, but you didn't build the mountain the house is on. And it's Yahweh who makes your mountain stand strong. And if he ever hides his face, we will be dismayed, along with David. So you have the idea. So in the opening, in those first five verses, there's just this general recognition of the contrast between what I would have been without God and what I am because I know Yahweh. It's like an introduction to the psalm. So now we start the journey by realizing that before we called out to God, he was the one who was already providing the steady ground on which we were walking. When we thought, look how fast I can run, he was saying, well, how fast can you run without ground? We need everything that God provides, and God provides everything that makes it possible for us to have anything at all. So we don't realize God's always been delivering us from the beginning until he doesn't. Then what do? Well, the same thing David does in this story. And so in verses 8 through 10, he goes like this, starting in verse 8. He says, to you, O Lord, I cry, and to the Lord I beg for mercy. What profit? It's as if he begins to negotiate with God, but it's not a negotiation where he feels like he has leverage. That's how some people would read this, like he's bargaining with God. Well, if you want praise, you're going to have to keep me alive. He's not saying that. He's saying, I know you created me for something, and I don't know how I can do that if you don't deliver me now. Please deliver me so that I can give back to you what is yours. What profit is there in my death? If I go down to the pit, and remember at the beginning, he was talking about being delivered from that pit. So he says, if I go down to the pit, what profit is there in that death? Will the dust praise you? Will it tell of your faithfulness? There's nothing in this statement where he's saying, I wouldn't have a soul to praise you. He's talking about in this world, who's going to open their mouth and actually sing the praises to you? In other psalms, we're going to know that the rocks themselves will cry out. David knows that. He knows nature itself declares the glory of God. It's not that. He's saying, you created me to praise you. I'm telling you, I want to do that now. And if you put me in the pit, if I die now, how will I do that? Let me praise you. And so he says, what profit is there in my death if I go down to the pit? Will the dust praise you? Will it tell of your faithfulness? Hear, Yahweh, and be merciful to me. Oh, Yahweh, be my helper. He doesn't say, hear, Yahweh, and be smart. I got praise for you, and you're not going to get it if I die. Again, it's not a negotiation. He's begging for nothing but mercy to be able to give back to God what he realizes now he received from God to begin with. Lord, I realize this. I understand. You put me here for this purpose. How will I do that if I die? So let me give this back to you, Lord. Hear, O Yahweh. Be merciful to me, O Lord. Be my helper. What's that mercy that he's calling for? Well, the next part of the story that we were reading, so we're skipping back out of the Samuel and Saul confrontation. Remember, we were talking about David having realized in verse 10, his heart strikes him. He has sinned greatly. He's done very foolishly. And, you know, just after that, Gad comes to him and gives them the options. So, Yahweh's given you options. You can have a famine, or your foes can chase you around, or you can have 3 days of pestilence. And David says, let me fall into the hands of Yahweh. So Yahweh sent a pestilence on Israel from the morning until the appointed time. So that's why I said, it seems like it would be 3 days, since that's what he said he was going to do. And so he says, until the appointed time. And there died of the people from the north to the south, 70,000 men. And when the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem, this is the angel that's brought the destruction, the pestilence. The angel is this embodiment of the pestilence. Whichever way you want to take that, I still think it's a real angel. I'm not doubting that. But it's certainly an embodiment of the pestilence in the story. And there died of the people from Dan to Beersheba, 70,000 men. And when the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it, now, see, it's been all of the land of Israel, but now it's coming to Jerusalem itself. The Lord relented, as the ESV says it, from the calamity, and said from the evil, and said to the angel who was working destruction among the people, I hate it when we hedge our words. You know, it's pretty direct in the text. He repented of the evil that was happening and said to the angel who was working destruction among the people, it is enough. Now stay your hand. And the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Ornan, it says in the ESV in this part, in 2 Samuel, and it's written that way. But it's we call him Ornan in 1 Chronicles as the story is told. So I'll call him Ornan. And the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Ornan, the Jebusite. He had a place where he threshed his wheat and stuff. And so David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking the people, and he said, behold, I have sinned. Here he is calling out for mercy, as he does in Psalm 51 after Bathsheba, and as he does in this case. He is a man who repents. He pours his heart out before Yahweh. And so he says, as he did in verse 10, David's heart struck him. I have sinned greatly. I've done very foolishly. Now he says to the Lord himself, behold, I have sinned and I have done wickedly. But these sheep, what have they done? This messianic prayer now as he intercedes on behalf of the people. And he says, now he's not Jesus. He's not perfect. He's not the Son of God become man who's walking on the earth, but he is their messianic figure. He is their king who intercedes on their behalf and is offering himself up on their behalf. I have sinned, not them. Let me face the judgment, not them. But these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and against my father's house. We heard Moses do this, but it was when the people were the ones who were guilty, right? Every messianic figure does this. I am willing to go in and stand before the king, not knowing if he'll raise his scepter. But I'm willing to go because my people need to be delivered from this judgment. So you go and we'll fast for you 3 days, 3 nights. But then I think the Lord will raise you up. And Esther walks in and he raises his scepter, right? Every messianic figure does this. You have to be willing to go into the pit so that you arise as a slave in Egypt to deliver your people. And in this case, David goes into the pit, seeing the evil that has come on his people. And he says to Yahweh, I'm the one who sinned. I have done wickedly. These sheep, what have they done? Man, wouldn't you love to see spiritual leaders who remember that this is our calling? Not that we find people we can judge. Not that we stand in the pulpit with the ability to point our finger and condemn. I am among the greatest of the Pharisees. You have failed. We pronounce everyone else's sins. But instead, for someone to stand in the pulpit and say, I have a heart that's not pure. I am the one who has sinned. Lord, these are your people. Take my life, not theirs. Judge me, not them. Let me serve. Let me die. Anything but protect them. That's what David does for his people. That's what Jesus does for his people. And we are called to be like him. But anyway. Behold, I have sinned and I have done wickedly, David says, but these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and against my father's house. And he goes on. So there's, you know, there's this first part of this where he's calling for mercy for his people. And in the psalm that we were reading, when he says, I cry to the Lord, I plead for mercy. What profit is there in my death if I go down to the pit? What he's saying now in this prayer is, what profit is there in the death of your people? They're your sheep. Allow them to be lifted up. Let your hand be against me and against my father's house. And God came in verse 18 that day to David and said to him, go up, raise an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So David, Jebusite, you know, Jebus is the original name of the city, Jerusalem, where Jerusalem is. And so he was from there. So he's a Jebusite, Jebusite. So David went up at God's word as the Lord commanded. And when, and if you know the story, you know what this leads to. And so David goes to Ornan's threshing floor where this was happening. David went up at God's word as the Lord commanded. And when Ornan looked down, he saw the king and his servants coming on toward him. And Ornan went out and paid homage to the king with his face to the ground. And Ornan said, why has my lord the king come to his servant? And David said, to buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to Yahweh, that the plague may be averted from the people. And Ornan goes through this episode, and we'll talk about it in a moment, where he wants to just give it to him. He recognizes the significance of this. The importance for us is to realize that as David is coming to Yahweh, to God, and saying, have mercy on your people, please deliver them and stop this judgment. Oh, please, God, because we know protection has to always come from you. So we realize it can only be built on you. So we come to you and ask for help. What Yahweh says in response is, build an altar and ask for my mercy. Build an altar where you will be able to call on my name for this mercy. That's what David is going to do. He has called for mercy, and now Yahweh is saying, so institute it. Make it something you can do regularly so the people will remember that mercy comes from me. And so he says, so in the next part of the psalm, verse 11, we pick it up, and it says, this is David saying now in the psalm, you have turned for me, this is verse 11 and 12, this is where it closes, you have turned for me my mourning into dancing. So remember, we originally saw, you know, weeping only endures for a night, joy comes in the morning. Now that joy has come, the morning has come, the Lord's deliverance has come. And so David says in verse 11, you have turned for me my mourning into dancing. You have released my sackcloth, taken it off of me, and clothed me with gladness, that my glory may sing your praise and be not silent. O Lord Yahweh, my God, I will give thanks to you forever. And remember, this is in the superscript, a psalm of David, a song at the dedication of the temple. So, you know, so this turning of David's mourning into dancing and taking off the sackcloth of his sorrow and replacing it with the clothing of gladness and making the promise that now he's going to sing praises to God and not be silent and to do it forever, giving thanks. Those reminders are the statements at this dedication of the temple of why the people would be coming into the temple. Why would you come into this temple? Because the Lord, because we remember where we came from. The Lord has turned our mourning into dancing. He converted the sackcloth of our grieving into this robe that we wear that celebrates with gladness. And we promise that we would celebrate that gladness forever so that our glory sings praise to the Lord forever and we give thanks to him forever. It never stops. So when we come into the temple, we remember that. Well, what happens in the story next, just after he comes to Ornan. Ornan says, oh, well, I'll just give it to you, David. You don't have to buy it from me. I mean, this plague is affecting everyone. All of us need to be delivered. So I'll give it to you. And the Messiah figure says, no, it's not free to me. I purchase it for our people. So I'm going to purchase it from you. In verse 24, the king says to Ornan, no, I will buy it from you for a price. I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God that cost me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver, and David built there an altar to the Lord, and he offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So the Lord responded to the plea for the land, and the plague was averted from Israel. And if I can read it to you instead for a moment from 1 Chronicles, I've been reading you the episode from 2 Samuel, especially in chapter 24, but the story from 1 Chronicles concludes this way at that time, and it's told from a slightly different perspective, but you'll see the relationship. At that time, and this is the same moment when he's going to Ornan, it says, at that time when David saw the Lord, this is in 1 Chronicles 21, that the Lord had answered him at the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, he sacrificed there. Because the tabernacle of the Lord, which Moses had made in the wilderness, and the altar of burnt offering, were at that time at the high place at Gibeon. But David couldn't go before it to inquire of God because he was afraid of the sword of the angel of the Lord. So he couldn't go up to Gibeon to offer prayers because he's in this immediate, urgent need to be praying before Yahweh because of the pestilence that's on the people right now. And so David says, when he's gone up to the threshing floor of Ornan, David says, this is where, here shall be the house of the Lord God, and here the altar of burnt offering for Israel. And we know, because of what transpires, that he's not simply saying, we're going to move the tabernacle down here to where Ornan's threshing floor is. He's saying, we are going to build the house for the Lord that I wanted to build, but the Lord told me I couldn't because I have blood on my hands. But my son is going to build it. Now we know where to build it. We're going to build it where the Lord is. He's come down here and delivered us. His mercy has shown up for us here. And so David offers this prayer. Then think about this. This statement that David makes, this promise that David makes. You have turned for me my mourning into dancing. You have loosed my sackcloth and clothed me with gladness that my glory may sing your praise and not be silent, O Lord my God. I will give thanks to you forever. This dedication of the temple in which he promises to give thanks to the Lord forever, he offers before there is a temple building. And I think it makes sense to hear that statement in the context of him on Ornan's threshing floor, saying to the people, look how the Lord has brought us up from this pit. Look how he has delivered us from these 3 days and nights of desolation, but that weeping only endures for a moment. The joy endures forever. That the Lord gives us, and no one can take away. And so when David offers this prayer before the temple is built, knowing that he's going to make the temple there, you know, what's going to make the temple there holy is that Yahweh is there. Not thinking to himself, well, you know, maybe we can get Yahweh to come and bless us because we build a temple. I mean, this is after this plague that he's on Ornan's threshing floor saying to the people instead, look, we know Yahweh is the one who built our mountain. And I was sitting up there on my throne thinking to myself, hey, it's my charisma. It's my ability to build an army. It's my power with the people that's keeping us safe. In fact, we better count those people and make sure I've still got enough. That's him just being like Saul. And when he's confronted with it and confesses and says, and then I remembered, it was Yahweh who built my life. It was Yahweh who built the mountain. He was the one who was keeping me safe even when I was acting like it was me. And when he stopped, I realized that I had turned away from him. But when I called out to him again, when I turned to him, he had mercy. And he poured it out and he gave me life. And he said, in that moment, I realized that I was never going to turn away from him again. So let's build a temple here so that all of us remember to bring our praise into the temple when we come to worship Yahweh. Well, you know how, I mean, look, this is not a hard transition to understand what that means to us. We are the temple of the Holy Spirit. In our world, we show people the presence of Yahweh in their world because he dwells in us. We are the temple of the Holy Spirit. Everywhere we go, and I mean this communally as a congregation, a church, but I also mean it to us as individuals, as believers. Everywhere we go, we should have on display that we know the things David is talking about here in this psalm. We know that every good thing we have, even before we knew it, is from God. It's a gift from him. That when we asked for mercy, He gave it. So in that light, my prayer for us in the light of Psalm 30, the dedication of the temple on Ornan's threshing floor after the judgment of God, is may the Lord's presence in us be revealed in our temple worship, in our existence with God's presence played out in our lives. May it be known in our temple worship through our humility, our gratitude, our joy. Those are not new concepts to us as believers. The way Paul says it in 1 Thessalonians 5 is rejoice, pray, and give thanks, because this is the will of God. In Philippians 4, he says rejoice, and by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. All of that is built on us remembering that every good thing we have, even before we knew God, was a gift from him, and that when we finally turned and asked for mercy, because we realized that if he turned away, we would be dismayed. When we turned and asked for mercy, he gave it. And so may the Lord's presence in us be revealed in our temple worship through humility and gratitude and joy.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.